On the Empire podcast this week, Darren Aronofsky gets biblical on our asses as he talks about Noah. Anne Hathaway stops singing like a nightingale and starts singing like a parrot for Rio 2. And we discuss the rest of the week's releases, including Divergent and The Double, on the only movie podcast that is directly inspired by a story by Dostoevsky. And by that, of course, we don't mean the idiots, so shut up. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire podcast. Joining me this week are the three Empire riders who were caught in the London smog this morning, and it was so thick they didn't notice the rope traps I rigged outside the office door. First up is Ali Plum, who, if he were in Divergent, would choose abnegation, because every week he selflessly edits this podcast for your listening pleasure and also looks good in grey. Hello, Ali.
Hello, that's kind of you to say. I don't really have any comment.
Okay. Next, we've got Phil de Semelin, whose faction would be erudite since he's terribly well read and can hopefully tell me who this Dostoevsky bloke is.
What?
Yeah?
Yeah.
And finally, here's Nick de Semelin, who would clearly join Amity since he calls people neighbour even if they live on the other side of London.
I call one person neighbour, Chris Hewitt. We never live next door to each other. But I must say, in Captain America Winter Soldier, Captain America's neighbour calls him neighbour at one point. So
hey,
it's obviously becoming a thing.
You have set a trend, which is now being followed by Captain America's neighbour. All this week, the questions have been flooding in and sloshing around this pod arc. And we're going to start with at V511 says, Dirty Harry, Dirty Dozen, Dirty Dancing, Kiss, Marry or Kill?
That's a weird question.
It's a very weird question. I had to choose it. I'm sorry.
It proved the weirdness levels of that question.
I think I'd have to kill Dirty Dozen because, you know, kill or be killed. And I think Dirty Dancing you'd probably marry, which means that I'm kissing a Callahan. So, yeah, that's what I've got.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm kissing Clint Eastwood.
My only thought on this is I wouldn't marry Dirty Harry because he has a farting bulldog called Meathead, which I think would get on your nerves after a while.
Also, can you imagine the arguments if you married Callahan? I mean, they would be tempestuous.
Let's go on to the next one. At @Bill_Sitch asks, what's your favourite final shot in a film? Mine's the shot of the house at the top of the falls in Up, which is lovely. Good choice, Bill.
Mine would have to be the crane shot as Stereophonics Maybe Tomorrow starts belting through the sky at the very end of the Oscar-winning
no,
Best Picture
don't say
Crash.
It. Oh, come on. Really?
No.
Oh, jeez.
No, not really.
I knew you were going to say that.
I don't actually have one. This isn't something that I've thought of. I've got several things that spring to mind, like Inception recently is obviously one that stays long in the memory, you know, with the spinning top. But you could also say, you know, Planet of the Apes is one that would, I guess, turn up in many lists like this.
That's
Searchers.
Searchers is a classic.
Freeze frame ending, that's something Chris and I love a lot. There's a fantastic freeze frame ending for Hot Rod. Two characters fight and one is victorious after a long series of not being able to be victorious, and it's this great fist pumping action shot which I really love.
Breakfast Club has got
Breakfast
great
Club,
has got
yeah.
great
that's quite a good
one. That could be the definitive one. I'm also thinking Beverly Hills Cop, where Axel Foley just turns to the camera and goes, you can't really see it on a podcast what I'm doing, but I'm essentially making a circle with my finger and thumb.
On that note, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid is the one of that. Like, it is the freeze frame ending.
Phil, 400 Phil, blows.
I knew that was coming.
Seriously.
That was actually on my list as well.
Oh, come on.
It was.
Yeah, 400 blows. Gallipoli's got a great one as well, actually. And that where it kind of fades to... It fades into a sepia picture, I think, as well, which
that's
I love.
That's always nice.
Yeah. Ghostbusters 2, you're pretty sure
2,
it doesn't end with Gozer running along the beach and
whatever,
just staring into the camera.
I can't think of it
black
off the top
white.
Of my head, but I'm sure it's astonishing.
It is astonishing.
Yeah. Casino Royale
I know it
has
is.
The name's Bond, James Bond.
Right.
What about Back to the Future?
How about The Shining?
The Shining's great. There's so many great ones. 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Is that the fetus?
With the giant space fetus.
I'm going to throw in Rebecca with the, you know, the house is on fire and the camera goes through the window and there's a handkerchief with the letter R on it, which is great.
Yeah. I like that.
And originally, David O. Selznick, who produced, this is a bit of trivia, wanted it to pan up into the sky where the smoke from the fire is forming the letter R. But Hitchcock said, that's stupid.
That's
my all-time favourite last shot has to be Raiders of the Lost Ark. Come on, guys. Raiders.
Yeah. What happens in that
not
one?
Like
are they in like a?
It's where Indy turns to the camera and just goes, "Yeah!" Does big thumbs up.
He
and
does
five solar.
He plunges the sky and then
see you next time.
And a big '80s riff just blasts out your speakers.
Don't you forget about me.
For the 1940s jazz version, the late '30s. What about the sort of ambiguous endings? I'm gonna Hayden Cachet, for instance.
Okay.
Where it just ends with the with the shot of the on the steps of the school, and you and the answer maybe lies in there somewhere of what's happened, or maybe it doesn't.
Or how about Shallow Grave?
Great films that have final opening and bookmarked by the same shot, like Carlito's Way, has, you know, comes back to that point. I just watched Wake in Fright, which is out on DVD and Blu-ray. It's a classic Australian movie, which I hadn't seen before, which does that, ends with a the circularity of this guy's journey, ending up back where he came from, with a kind of a crane shot over a deserted kind of outback train station, which reminded me a bit of Once Upon a Time in the West. Fight Club? Anyone?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Speaking of Fight Club, Rocky, he has a face like a like someone sat on a watermelon. There's a tear trickles out his eye. That's just after Edward! Which is nice.
We got to put a word in for shock endings, where in the last shot you're going, oh, this is nice, and then something like, and freaks you out. Is the ultimate one Carrie? I think it might be.
I watched the
remake of Carrie on the weekend, which is actually okay. It's all right, but they completely arse up the final shot, where instead of a hand coming out of the grave, you just hear a yeah, and then the CG cracks on the thing. There's no arm comes out. Come on, put the arm in.
Well, it's all a bit out of keeping with the book, isn't it? Which is more of like a tragic story of this poor abused girl who, you know, goes a bit nuts. Rather, because the arm out of the grave is a bit, I mean, it's, don't get me wrong, it's brilliant, but it is also just a shock.
Helen, don't make me go, ah!
Oh, God!
Yep.
The thing
is a great ending, but it doesn't have that. It could have that, I suppose. Could it? Could it have that? Where it's just...
No, it's perfect as it is.
It's sort of perfect as it is.
I think if the sort of hand came out of the
The dog came back.
And both The Apartment and Some Like It Hot have just great... They're more or less lines than... It's the line as much as the shot, but they're pretty perfect.
The Apartment's good, yeah. They're on the sofa playing that card game. And
Shut Up and Deal.
What's the name of that card game? I always forget. It's like... It's Gin Rummy they're playing. Wrestler, is that a freeze frame ending? When he's leaping off the...
It is, yeah.
That's a really good one on that topic. I'd also mention The Graduate's bus as it drives off.
Yeah. Or Wayne's World 2.
Yes.
Which, you know, does the same thing, but slightly better.
A little bit better. Improves on the original quite substantially.
Has Christopher Walken in it.
That's all I need.
That's enough for me.
Should we end this with a bleh?
White Heat.
Okay.
That's a bit of a bleh.
Made it mar.
I think we've just about exhausted that one. Thank you very much, Bill, for that question. Next up, at Hannah Dowell asks, who is the greatest Disney sidekick?
I think Helen and I would both say we could do a whole podcast on this. Such a big question. I've long thought about this. Since year dot, I've thought about this. But it's got to be Toby, the massive dog from Basil, the Great Mouse Detective. And I'll tell you why. Because he's a massive dog. He's a very, very good scent-sniffing super hound. And he loves crumpets. And that's all I need from a sidekick in a Disney movie, is a big, adorable animal.
That is compelling. But, like, Thumper in Bambi, like, thumps his foot really hard.
Yeah,
so...
that's a good point. Gun to my head, probably say Genie, right? If you include him
if
as a sidekick.
If he's a sidekick.
The debate here is he actually just a main character, is he a sidekick? Like, I would say Mushu is a sidekick in Mulan.
Mm. Yeah.
And he's great. He's kind of Genie-light. But I really love the bit where he's up in the top of one of the palace towers and he says, I'm your worst nightmare, dressed as Batman, which is beautifully out of context. And I would also mention Pascal from Tangled, the little chameleon, who's very cute. Similarly, non-speaking, cute animal thing. I've got a thing for the non-speaking animals.
I have a question on this topic. Are you allowed to have a villain sidekick?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because I would suggest Kronk from Emperor's New Groove.
Kronk, I'm not familiar with Kronk's work.
Kronk is the best. Kronk's New Groove is terrible, the sequel, direct to DVD, but Kronk in Emperor's New Groove is...
And that's worth watching, because I always see that on Netflix,
If you have a spare 90 minutes, watch Emperor's New Groove. Do not watch Kronk's New Groove. Put it this way, Kronk is a lug-headed... He's played by the same guy who plays Puddy in Seinfeld, and who was also in the B-movie. He has an innate talent of being able to speak to squirrels, so that's just great. Mm.
I was thinking of the parrot from Aladdin, Jafar's.
Yes.
Is that Iago?
Iago, yeah.
Yeah, which implies that he's kind of really behind the scenes of everything. He's whispering in people's...
Iago.
There's Maximus the horse from Tangled. Sven, isn't it? The reindeer from Frozen.
They're very similar.
Very similar.
I thought he was a moose, but my...
No, he's a reindeer.
Who's Robin Hood's sidekick?
well, it would probably be Little John, but is he a sidekick?
Yeah, I mean, he's more of a main character.
You get into the Baloo issue
side
as well.
The Baloo issue.
The big Baloo debate.
I mean, I remember reading that in Sight and Sound when I was much younger. The Baloo debate.
Flounder, obviously, in The Little Mermaid.
Flounder's a prat.
Flounder's a great example, though.
What's the name of the lobster from Little Mermaid?
Sebastian.
You mean
Sebastian.
The crab?
Oh, God.
What about Dumbo's pal?
Oh, the mouse. I don't think he's a sidekick.
What is he?
I feel like he's too much of a lead thing. I just don't know. This is so difficult for
tricky.
Me.
It's challenging. What about
Jiminy Cricket?
That's what I meant. Jiminy Cricket.
Jiminy Cricket, actually, that's kind of pretty good. That's a pretty good argument right
now. He's kind of sidekick stroke pious moral guardian.
I find him a bit irritating.
Because he's a pious moral guardian.
A bit irritating, isn't he?
You know what he'd say to that?
He'd say, hey, you need doodly. He's, yeah, he's
saying,
the Ned
you
Flanders
need to think about
of the
Pinocchio-verse. That's a little harsh, don't you think?
Yeah. A sub-question to this is, what's the best sidekick song in a Disney movie? And I think the winner of that is Cogsworth and Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast. That
Be Our Guest. Amazing.
That is such a great, huge, triumphant, gorgeous song, and it's totally them. And they're great fun. And I'd also mention, from a more recent Disney movie, Princess and the Frog, I love Ray. Louis deserves a mention, the jazz-loving, trumpet-playing alligator. But Ray, the buck-toothed, star-loving light bug, is cute as a bun.
I like talking about villainous sidekicks, Cruella de Vil's goons. They're pretty entertaining.
They're quite fun, yeah.
Why does she hire them? They're literally incompetent.
I think this is a key to being a really great Disney villain, because I think, like, Maleficent is my favourite by a country mile Disney villain, but she does, in fairness, hire really incompetent sidekicks who spend 16 years looking for a baby. The only way that you get a really good villain in a Disney movie, because otherwise, obviously, because they're a good villain, they'd have killed the whoever in about 5 seconds flat. So the only way they can be stopped from killing the whoever in 5 seconds flat is to have really incompetent help. So it's the only they have to have that weakness. They have to have that Achilles heel.
Yeah, if like Cruella de Vil had Leon's phone number or
exactly
Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction.
Well, then we'd be in some serious
movie.
Trouble. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. They're fun though.
They are.
They're fun and kind of charming.
We haven't mentioned Rowan Atkinson's character in The Lion King. Whose name escapes me. So he's probably not that good.
Zazu?
Zazu sounds
Is
right.
Is it Zazu? Yeah, that's in my head. I get Zazu.
And then you got Pumbaa and Timon.
I don't think they count as sidekicks because they're a comedy double act. It's like those mice from Cinderella.
Well, it's like Chip and Dale.
Yeah.
Although I kind of think Dale is Chip's sidekick.
So. Ooh, ouch.
Chip is getting the business done.
Getting the business done.
Getting down to business.
He's taking names.
I think so. Mostly his own.
Well, Rescue Rangers is apparently being turned into a film, so look forward
to
that.
I'm on board.
I'm really on board. I mean, it's obviously it's just a pastiche of other things, but it's great.
Okay, I think we have conclusively failed to answer that one. Next up, a quick question from Ross Miller, at Ross T. Miller, in fact. He asks, we all hate those who disrupt others at the cinema, but have you ever been the one to be disruptive? Fess up.
Hell yes.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I have.
Gorgeous.
I have, actually. I'll be honest. Chris and I went to a multimedia screening of 2012, the Roland Emmerich disaster flick, and we spent quite a lot of time making sarky comments to each other about what was happening on screen, ironically high-fiving, and generally being obnoxious about the whole thing. I mean, we had a blast, but James, who was sitting next to us, tells me that we were slightly annoying. So, sorry, anyone who's in the vicinity.
You didn't actually get told off by anyone.
No, we didn't.
I've been told off by someone.
Oh, no.
But it is a great injustice, which to this day I am bitter and protest of. I got told off during a screening of Predators for breathing too loudly, which is quite ironic in a film about a creature that breathes really loudly. But I had a bit of a cold, but I wasn't aware of it. And Chris was with me. He didn't hear me, so I'm quite annoyed at the lady who turned around to me in the middle of the film and went, for goodness sake, stop breathing so loudly! And I was, the rest of the movie, I was just sitting there going, ah. I should have said something.
Stop breathing.
Should have said something witty back, but I, yeah.
That, wow.
Like what?
I don't know. You stop breathing so loudly. I should have said that, if only I had thought of it at the time. But no, it was upsetting.
I can't believe anybody would ever say that. My biggest... it's terrible, really, but I was at the Filmhouse Cinema in Edinburgh, which is a lovely art house cinema, and I went to go and see, with my girlfriend at the time, White Christmas. Obviously, it was December
Great.
Time, and it was a matinee, and lots of old folk were in there. There was barely anyone in there. And we were just a little bit kind of hot-toddy drunk, and were laughing and just saying things, and, oh, I love this song type stuff. And an old lady which I loved, really. I'm totally at fault here. Came four seats. She was four rows behind us. Walked down in the middle of the film.
Uh-oh.
And was like, "You must be more respectful to cinema." And I was like, "Yeah, yep, yeah, you got it. I'm absolutely right." And so, yeah, you just have that feeling terrible for the next hour. But yeah, I'm sorry, old lady. Lovely old lady.
She might have been in the film.
She could have been in the film, yes. Yeah.
The lady in front of you at Predators clearly wasn't in Predators.
I don't know.
No.
She was frightening looking.
Have you seen her since?
No.
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 Gosh.
No.
That's a tough one, isn't it? Because like breathing is not, it's not like eating popcorn or taking phone calls.
No.
You kind of need to do it a bit. At least.
It was a loud film as well. I don't know.
It's a really loud film.
What kind of noises I was making.
Yeah.
But,
How about you, Phil? Have you ever, you know, unconsciously mouthed along in French while watching something?
Just shouting. I think just general, probably just generally annoying, I think.
Weren't eating couscous too loudly.
Throwing my couscous around. No, I don't know. I couldn't. I'd probably eat Pick and Mix too loudly. Just general disruption. Snoring.
Yes, it's really important not to do that, Phil, when you go and see films.
Waking up suddenly.
You really did love Noah, didn't you?
I did love, no.
On an unrelated note.
Oh, come
note.
On, no.
Have any of you guys fallen asleep during a film?
Yeah. I fell asleep during Tron Legacy. Mm. I was exhausted. I'd come back from a trip to America, and it was the day afterwards, and was really looking forward to it. It didn't help that the film wasn't very good, but I was, in the IMAX screen. Like, that's how excited I was to see it.
It gets quite chilled at a certain point. You know, Jeff Bridges, sort of weird, sort of CG
Zen master.
Jeff Bridges starts doing some space yoga.
That was enough for me.
Cyber yoga, whatever it is, and it starts getting quite mellow.
I kept having little micro sleeps during A Serious Man. Not because it wasn't good, it was obviously brilliant, but because I was just off a flight and I thought, it's like, but it's the Coens, I really want to see it, I'm going to go anyway, I can stay awake. I couldn't stay awake.
There's a flight from Paris, Helen. Come on.
I missed the second act of Dark Shadows, but I haven't.
Didn't miss a lot.
To check it out.
Didn't miss a lot.
You missed the second. You just fell asleep for just the second act.
Oh yeah, third act was great.
The resolution. You're awake and ready to go. Well, don't ask me because everybody knows. fell asleep in Pacific Rim.
There you go.
Oh, Phil.
And we had the Empire Awards, of course, this week. Now all our coverage is online, empireonline.com/awards2014. You can see all the coverage of the night and all the winner speeches and everything else. It was fantastic. The reason I mention this is because we have a question about it. Barry Morgan, who goes by @MrDickSplash, asks, "What was your favourite moment from the night? Wait, is the answer just going to be Emma Thompson?"
Yes.
Well, yes.
Yep. Pretty much.
Yes.
I mean, not to, you know, denigrate our other guests. There were other great speeches. Arnold Schwarzenegger brought the house down with a very, very funny speech. James McAvoy made everyone take a drink before he would leave the stage.
He was having a good time.
He'd already had a couple, perhaps, himself. He also, fun fact, puts his jacket on exactly the same way that President Bartlett does in the West Wing. So that was cool.
I must say, tangentially on the Emma Thompson thing, it was fantastic seeing seeing Tom Cruise.
Uh-huh.
And Tom Cruise turned around and saw Emma Thompson, who they obviously know each other, but they hadn't seen each other for a long time. He goes, "Hello, love!" in what must be the worst Cockney accent. But that was an amazing moment.
That's pretty cool.
I stumbled upon Sally Hawkins mid-conversation with Arnie.
Wow.
That's incredible.
I'm assuming they were talking about Predator. It's hard to tell, but that was pretty... that's unusual. That was unusual, but
maybe
cool.
He was praising Blue Jasmine. Maybe he's a huge Woody Allen fan.
Or Mike Lee fan.
Or Mike Lee
fan. He's always
fan.
Wanted to work with Mike Lee.
I enjoyed seeing Edgar Wright geeking out as he met Arnie for the first time. Arnold just sort of walked up to him and went, "Good to see you," and then walked off. And they'd never met before. And he was pretty excited about that.
That's pretty cool.
And we also had Brian Cox meet Professor Brian Cox.
Whoa.
That was pretty cool. And the two of them revealed that they've been mistaken for each other, you know, on a lot of occasions and been asked to do bits of work that the other one was actually wanted for. So, you know, the actor Brian Cox would turn up and be expected to give a lecture on quantum mechanics, and Professor Brian Cox would be expected to talk about the Bourne trilogy, and it all got very confusing, apparently.
I would like to see that. We have to get the Chris Evanses together next year, don't we? That's the only way we can top this.
Yes, there we go. That's on our to-do list for 2015. So, yes, incredible awards. Do check it out online if you haven't already. And also, you know, enter the Done in 60 Seconds competition next year. You could be there with us. Okay, time for our first interview now. Our guest is one of only two people to have won an Oscar and also played Catwoman. And in a fight between the two, we think she'd win because her Catwoman didn't suck. Anne Hathaway rose to fame in a number of smarter-than-your-average teen movies and moved up the A-list thanks to the likes of The Devil Wears Prada, Becoming Jane, and, of course, Les Miserables. As she reprises her role as Jewel in the Rio sequel, we sent Phil and Ali along to talk to her.
What's your favourite English snack? Do you have such a thing?
Yeah, I think my favourite is salt and vinegar chips. Crisps. Thank you so much. And so I like that one. Yeah, that one's the one that I kind of miss. I mean, you can get them in the States, but it's not really the same thing because I'm usually having it with a beer, a lager. And I don't know, does a Pimm's cup like count as a snack? I feel like there's so much fruit
in it. It's got a lot of like cucumber.
I feel like it's kind of like an alcoholic salad.
It's a drink and then it becomes a snack at the bottom. And the question is how dedicated you are to plucking out all of the vegetables.
It depends on how many I've had because drunken dedication is a very serious thing.
Because the booze may soak into the cucumber.
Some more silly questions. Right, so there is a talent competition in Rio 2. If you were in a talent competition, imagine that, and you were asked to display a talent, what would your talent be? You cannot sing.
Okay. This is going to sound so lame. I'm really good at packing a suitcase.
Wow. So good that you'd want to show it off?
I don't know that I'd necessarily want to show it off. I'm also really good at organizing. Mm. So I might want to just like be blindfolded, like walk into like a really disorganized closet and then be able to put it in order in like under a certain amount of time.
Do you rearrange your DVDs and your Blu-rays and that sort of book stuff in like chronological and alphabetical stuff? You're that level?
Well, when I finally got to move into my home... That sounded weird. When I moved into my home, I got all my books out of storage. When I said the finally, they'd been in storage for many, many years. I got them out and I did do them chronologically, alphabetically, all that stuff. But then I didn't like the way they looked. So then I did them in order by rainbow color.
Rainbow color? Because I couldn't tell you how the colors align on the rainbow, like off the top of my head.
Where'd you biv?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
It's the acronym, right?
I didn't know that was an acronym. Okay.
And so, I mean, I didn't follow it to the letter of the law. I mean, the rainbow librarians are just going.
They're going to come and check.
They are not going to be impressed with my work. But no, so I just organized it by subject, and then within the subjects, I tried to organize them according to rainbow.
Okay. That's amazing. I've never heard that before. That's phenomenal.
I just love the idea of a rainbow librarian. But anyway,
they're out there and they're coming.
You know what? Now that the internet exists, I'm convinced that there's one of everyone. There's definitely a rainbow library. There's a rainbow library science enthusiast. I know it.
Mm. Agreed.
Driving vans around looking for people who have got the order slightly wrong in their DVD collection. Which of your DVDs, just on a quick side note, have you watched the most?
It's not a DVD, but can I go to VHS?
Yeah.
Waiting for Guffman.
I saw that for the first time just recently.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I did have got by the DVD at some point, but for the longest time it was my VHS that I watched the most. But the DVD, and I'm remembering, yes, I must have started watching it on DVD at some point, because have you ever seen the deleted scenes?
No.
Oh my God.
What's your favorite deleted scene from Waiting for Guffman?
Well, there's two. One is Parker Posey's audition monologue, in which she wrote it herself, and she's like such a genius. And it's her character, and she's written herself like the most dramatic, like flowers in the attic monologue about incest, and the whole thing is addressed to her brother who's lying on a life support system, and at the end I'm not even going to tell you because you got to see it, but just when she says the punchline at the end, think of me, and it's so great. And so that one, and then there's a song in it called Bulging River. And it's really, really good. And I think, I might get his name wrong, but it's Michael McKean, right?
Mm, yes. Yeah.
So he apparently was the one who wrote all the music for that movie. And they had to cut a bunch of it because they're like, it's too good. Like government, like this actually might have been able to do well. We had to cut a lot of it out to make it look more amateur.
Yes.
I have that problem with most of my work.
Being too good?
Just being a little too good.
That must be very tough for you. I'm sure you're very popular with everyone.
Speaking of define popular. I had a question. We really enjoyed your cameo in Don John.
Oh, thanks.
Last year in a rom-com alongside Channing Tatum, and you appeared on the alias Emily Lombardo.
Oh, I did?
You did, yeah. You weren't Anne Hathaway, you were Emily Lombardo. But I wondered, at Empire we give films ratings out of 5 stars.
Okay.
How many stars do you think special someone would get? And would it make a good date movie in real life?
Well, I have a question. At Empire, do you respect rom-coms?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, come on. That is not... Everything. I don't believe you. You're like... So I think it would depend on where it came down. I think we'd be a solid 3 or 2.5, you know, like...
A solid 3. That'll be in the movie poster. A solid 3, Empire.
We say that's a recommendation, so...
I think in the movie poster, it'd be like, the audience is 87% female.
Yeah. Perfectly decent.
Absolutely acceptable.
You give Channing Tatum a solid slap in one of the clips we see in the trailer for that film. And I believe Deborah Winger did something similar to you in Rachel Getting Married.
Yeah, except she really hit me.
She really hit
me. Channing, that was that we I don't.
You didn't hit Channing.
I didn't. He's just that good. He's just that good a physical comedian that he really, really sold it. But no, Deborah and I, you know, we had all this stunt training, and you know, Rachel Getting Married was such a, you know, a little film. Like, they like hired a stunt coordinator, and he like taught us it, and we spent like weeks rehearsing it. And then the first take, she just popped me right in the mouth. And I don't know if she'd want me to tell this story, but I'm going to tell it. So, she was so horrified by what happened, she had a physical reaction and like got a little sick, and then swallowed it, and then got sick. Like not ill. This sounds terrible. This is going where? This is going into a very bad place. But yeah, and so like, yeah, she popped me, and I don't think, and then we did take after take after take, and she missed me every single time. But of course, that one was the best because her reaction is just, it's just totally organic.
Right. Come on, who hasn't experienced guilt hives? You do something so
oh my
bad.
God, I know. Have you ever seen Keeping the Faith? It's a Ben Stiller movie he directed, or maybe Edward Norton. Edward Norton directed it with Ben Stiller. Anyway, one of them, Edward Norton plays a priest, Ben Stiller plays a rabbi, and he's having trouble finding love, and he goes on a date with this girl, and she's not the most ideal person to be on a date with, and he like goes to open up, he like goes to look at her, the books that are out, and it's hiding VHS exercise tapes, and so she sees him see them, and then she's like, oh my god, you found my tapes, they're my life, and she's like, seriously, my abs, they're like rocks, go on, hit me. And he's like, no, I really don't want to. And she's like, no, seriously, hit me. And he's like, no, I really don't. And she's like, come on. And she starts, you know, taunting him. And so then he punches her in the stomach, and then she just drops to the floor. It's a really good scene.
What's worrying is that a situation like that has happened to me in my life.
Literally?
Yeah, and the response from the girl was punching me in the face.
Where did she punch? Which part of your face?
She punched me just on the cheekbone. Yeah, I've actually still got a scar there. That is a genuine story.
Which, really?
Of no relevance to anybody, but that... It,
except Ben Stiller.
Yeah, Ben Stiller would love that story. Next time I see him.
Rachel Getting Married was a fantastic film, I thought. Really, really wonderful. And you shot it in 33 days with Jonathan Demme, the great Jonathan Demme of Silence of the Lambs fame. It looked like it was... It looked like a big sort of house party that you were shooting. I know that the material was very tough, and there were a lot of tough scenes in it, and your character goes through the whole gamut of emotion. What's your sort of a favorite memory from that period, from that particular? Do you have, like, is there one thing that springs to mind?
Thank you for bringing this film up, because I love talking about it. It's still like one of my professional, like, favorite things, and it was such an important film for me in my life, and it was just so great. You know, it took us a year to get financing, so from the time that, like, Jonathan and I met for the first time and discussed the character until we actually shot, it was a year. So we just worked on the character together for a year, and then when we were there, it was a little hard for me because my character was so isolated from everyone. So everyone else, you know, played a dozen instruments, and they would all sit around having, you know, jamming all the time, and I'd just be off in a corner sitting in a hammock smoking. I think, you know, my favorite, I have a few favorite memories on that one. One of them was Rosemarie DeWitt and I. We just kind of had this little intuitive thing with each other. We got together when she was cast, and of course she plays Rachel. We had a lovely, lovely dinner together, and we got to know each other. And then we pretty much didn't talk for the entire film, but it wasn't awkward. It was just kind of a vibe that we both decided to respect, an instinct that we both decided to respect, which was, let's not become besties. Let's respect the chasm between our characters. And so I think one of my favorite memories from that film was when it was finally all over and, you know, we were all up at the house anyway. And so we kind of had a barbecue, had a house party, and Rosemary came up to me with a bottle of wine and two glasses. And she said, now let's talk. And we just sat down and we had a few glasses of wine together and we talked about the experience. And it was really nice because, I mean, it, pretty amazing actually that we both were in the same place and we had never discussed how we were going to do it.
Yeah. Should have gone, nope, it's too late now. It's done. We've got to wrap, but just before we do.
Oh, you guys are lovely to talk to.
Well, you could come and see us again, I guess.
We said we were good.
Well, we were sort of lying, but it came off okay in the end. Just before we go, what can you not tell us about Interstellar? It's set in space, right?
No, that's good. That's a reveal. I'm taking it.
I can't tell. There's nothing I can tell you. It's a Chris Nolan movie, so we're all going to have our minds blown.
And you play Stella, right?
I play Inter.
He's watching. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Right, it's movie news time. What have you got for me today?
Let's talk about Frozen, because we just mentioned it with the reindeer, who is also a dog, Sven. I watched this last night because I thought, well, as the news has arrived that it's hit $1 billion in the worldwide box office, it just finished, well, it is finishing its final run in its final market, which is in Japan. It has now earned, obviously more than that at this current point, $1.072 billion, and it's only going up. It's coming out on DVD this week, so really, it's just going to never end. This is now the 10th biggest film of all time. Obviously, this does not account for inflation. There are plenty of movies that came out long, long time ago, 70 years ago, that would give this a run for its money, literally, including Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. But it is a huge success. There is no doubt about it. What I love is that when I mention this on the Empire Facebook page, it doesn't feel like it's very Empire at all. Like, everyone's reacted by going, oh, how has this movie got to $1 billion and I've never seen it? Well, because you haven't seen it. And lots of, I guess, young girls absolutely adore this film with its belting tunes and whatnot. It is the number one animated movie ever. It's a shame, obviously, its whole construct means that it can't be sequelized, but it could inspire another adjectival title, you know, slightly too beautiful filled princess film where they meet men and it's great.
I mean, to be honest, yeah, they're talking about a Frozen 2, even despite the lack of an obvious sequel, you know, thing there. I guess you could do something else with Elsa's power. You could have Anna suddenly discovering she's got the ability to do something or other, which leads to stuff and things.
Sven spin-off.
Olaf spin-off. I mean, that basically, with this kind of money in the bank, you can be sure they are going to do it. And you mentioned there in terms of inflation and so on. If you adjust for inflation, in modern dollars, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves has made $910 million in the US. So would do better than this worldwide, we think. But they haven't got worldwide figures going back far enough to be sure. But yeah, it's an incredible result for Disney. So, you know, bravo to them.
Yeah, it's interestingly, it pushed The Dark Knight Rises off the top 10 list.
Wow,
and it is the first
really?
Animated movie. No, it's after Toy Story 3, so it's the second animated movie to hit a billion.
That's amazing.
There you go. The other piece of news that I want to talk about in particular is that Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, which is the cult horror comedy starring Alan Tudyk and Tyler Labine, is going to get a sequel after a couple of years, actually. It was 2010 that this mock horror came out, and it's a lot of fun. I know Nick necessarily isn't the biggest fan, but Helen and I really, really enjoy it. The bit involving the bees and the chainsaw is very, very, very funny. So I think this is wonderful. This is getting a sequel. This feels like a movie that deserves it and could easily have more fun poking fun at other horror pastiches. The first one was a cabin in the woods hillbilly thing where they accidentally appear like they're mass murderers when it turns out it's just a series of incredibly lemony, snicket-like unfortunate events that have taken place where a bunch of teenagers accidentally die and it looks like they've done it. They could do this in a haunted house or in a castle or whatever, just take it to another spot and do it all over again.
To be fair, I did like it. My problem with it was it felt like a short film rather than it felt like a one joke thing. I thought they did the joke incredibly well, but over an hour and a half, I thought it wore a bit thin, and I'm not sure how in a sequel they're going to be able to sustain that. I mean, it's a great idea, it's a hilarious idea, it's kind of a, you know, could have been a Funny or Die short, but over a film, let alone a series, I don't know.
I didn't have that problem. I thought it had just about enough. Like, and especially the two leads are very likable characters, and they find other comic beats as well as just the sort of the mistaken a mistaken identity?
Kind of thing.
Mistaken
yeah.
identity.
Accidental death.
Accidental slaughter type scenario.
It's beautifully. I love it that it's beautifully balanced between the college kids assuming that these two hillbillies are redneck killers and these two hillbillies trying to figure out why these college kids keep killing themselves in front of them as it appears to them that they are doing, and they're very confused and worried by the whole thing. And they're just so good hearted. I put this on, I may have mentioned this in the podcast before, in fact, I put this on at Christmas, and my mum, who's not known for her love of horror movies, cackled her way through it with great glee. So I honestly think that if a sequel gets it to a bigger audience, that it could be a very good thing, because I think it's got an unlikely appeal to all sorts of people.
My other news, just to quickly talk about it, is that, you know how we mentioned a few months ago that Fantastic Beasts, which was that spin-off charity book that J.K. Rowling wrote, which is within the world of Harry Potter and essentially discusses different fantastical beasts within the world of Harry Potter, that is being turned into a film, but they're now saying, Warners are saying they want to turn it into a trilogy, kind of Hobbit style. So,
in the least surprising news ever.
Yeah, that's...
That's a thing.
That's a thing, and
I mean, it's way too early to say that this is necessarily a bad decision on the basis that we don't know what she's planning. The book itself gives you nothing to go on. It sets up this guy who's a magizoologist who's done all this research into magical beasts all over the world. The book is literally just a list of those beasts and a sort of a paragraph on each just explaining what they are and what they do. And there's, you know, it's some funny stuff and it's kind of charming. And if you've read the Harry Potter books, you know, some stuff that they refer to in passing is kind of explained there. So it's a nice little thing, but there's absolutely no story there. So whatever they're going to do, it's a blank slate really for a story, and as long as whatever they come up with is a good one, I guess fine.
And it is important to remember that J.K. Rowling is writing the scripts herself.
She is, yeah.
But we'll see. We'll
I
see.
Like beasts, magical beasts, even better. She's a great storyteller, so yeah. Until we see proof that it's not good, I'm down for this. Yeah. This sounds good to me.
And also, I love the setting. So this is set 70 years before the Harry Potter stories. Now, I know that they've been sort of filmed as modern day stuff, but strictly they're meant to be set in the 90s. But so if you take 70 years off, you're either talking 1920s or 1930s. Either way, it's a sort of a cool... Mm. It's kind of either Gatsby or,
steampunk.
You know, or Indiana Jones meets the world of Harry Potter. Mm. Those kind of combinations, I think, are really cool. Adele Blanc-Sec, maybe, is maybe a good thing to kind of use as a model. This could look just really, really wicked. Mm. So I hope they do something wicked with it.
I'm going to segue into my story.
Please do.
My story also has a kind of magical beast in the shape of a panther who is pink and rinky-dink. They are bringing the Pink Panther back to the screen. Not the Inspector Clouseau detective-y thing, but the actual Pink Panther. Apparently it's going to be a mix of live-action and animation, and it's going to be a kind of caper directed by Simpsons guy David Silverman, who I'm not familiar with, but if he's on The Simpsons, that's got to be good.
He did the Simpsons movie, didn't he?
Did he?
Yeah, I think
he directed it.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's not going to be good.
Oops.
How does that make you feel?
Well, mixture of emotions. So I need to step away from the mic for a sec. I like Pink Panther. I used to always prefer the kind of the intro with the Pink Panther, and then when it turned into a live action film, I was like, I want to see that Pink Panther doing stuff. I actually used to have a little kaleidoscope thing that was the Pink Panther running a car wash you could watch, but. Anyway, I'm up for this. I'm a fan of Pink Panthers. What do you guys think?
I think pink is a good colour for a panther.
I think it's a cute idea. I see what they're doing there. Obviously, they're trying to squeeze another drop out of this. But I certainly have enough affection for the kids' version back in the day. So. Yeah.
It feels like it's coming from a place of love rather than a cash-in, because, honestly, I don't think that many people are going, I want to see the Pink Panther movie.
I want to see a Pink Panther origin story.
How it becomes pink.
How it was pink. What the thing with the jewellery, where'd that come from? The bling.
He likes bling.
He likes bling.
He?
Yeah.
Well, why'd they name the diamond after him?
Why was he running a car wash then?
He drives that ridiculously fly sports car.
Yeah, there's a lot of origin to get into.
Wow.
So, get into it.
You're right.
He's a slick Rick.
You're literally the only person in the world who wants to hear that origin story. Tell me about your news, Phil.
Oh, my news. Well, they're making a movie entitled The Fantastic Four.
I am
aware of
it.
People may be familiar with the comic book property. And it's abortive adaptation a few years back. the man behind this, obviously Josh Trank from Chronicle, has staffed up his four, as we know, and he has now added a villain to their ranks, played by none other than Toby Kebbell.
Ooh.
Or, if you prefer, Toby Kebbell. And he will be playing Victor Von Doom, who I gather is something of a dark force in the world of the Fantastic Four.
He is.
And he's by no means a well-wisher.
I think that's a fair assessment. He is the ruler of Latveria, is he not?
Don't hurt me, Arch. I'm only little.
That kind of thing will be probably in the script, I'd imagine.
I really hope so.
Yeah. But Toby Kebbell is good because he felt like an actor that kind of really burst onto the scene. He was a BAFTA Rising Star nominee a few years back. He was fantastic in Control, Ian Curtis film, and the best thing in Rock and Roller. Then he was in Prince of Persia, where he played one of Dastan's
mead gulpers.
With eyebrows set to raise throughout and saying things like, Dastan and gossip. And that kind of nonsense. Which I don't think was the best showcase for his actual... He's a very charismatic screen presence. I think he'll be a good villain in this movie. I want to see him probably not behind a mask, ideally, because I think he's a very expressive, he's a talented actor. So
maybe they'll do some CG stuff to his face or something. I don't know. I mean, he is obviously also maybe not a bad guy, but certainly an antagonist, maybe, is perhaps a more accurate way of putting it, in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, is he not, this summer? So we won't be precisely seeing him, but we will underneath.
Mm. No, he's coming back. He feels like he had a little bit of a patch where he wasn't getting the big roles, but it feels like he's now really back on track. Mm-hmm. The Counselor had a kind of an unusual cameo in Ridley Scott's Counselor.
Yeah. He plays at the horse track.
Yeah, he had one scene opposite Michael Fassbender, which is just like, wow, where has he come from? And then he disappears, and you never see him again. But yeah, Dawn and this, and it's good to see him back because I think he's a really good actor. Mm-hmm. He was in War Horse, obviously, for the short kind of unnamed part.
So he's up against the Fantastic Four, who are, of course, now Miles Teller, Kate Mara, Michael B. Jordan, and Jamie Bell. Is that correct?
That is 100% Excellent. Correct and accurate.
So, best of luck to them. You know, they've got a formidable opponent. Mm. And hopefully he'll have some minions to keep all four of them busy at any one time.
Yeah, if he has some really inept goons, that would make
A big dog.
It's not a Disney film. Come on, though.
A big dog. Where's Latveria? Just out of interest.
It's in the middle of Europe. Why have one interview when you can have two? For our second one, Darren Aronofsky is the iconoclastic director of Pi, Requiem for a Dream, The Fountain, Black Swan, and The Wrestler. His new film, Noah, takes an epic, fantastical look at the biblical story of the flood, with Russell Crowe as the ark builder himself. We sent Phil and Ali along to interview him on Monday.
Which is just after the Empire Awards, which is why we're both kind of, let's say...
Low energy?
Professional.
Yeah, let's say we're incredibly professional. That's why we're quite incredibly professional.
You gave him your last Rolo.
I did. We had a long, long chat about how much he loves Rolos.
You heard it here first.
I'm going to start with a slightly, what may sound like a facetious question, but how do you have the balls to take on the Bible?
Oh, well, I don't know. I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I think it's like one of our oldest stories, right? It's a story that doesn't just belong to Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. It belongs to the world. It's like a UNESCO site. It's even if your culture doesn't know the Noah story, you have your own flood story, be you Aboriginal or Maya or Amazon or China. Everyone has a flood story, and there's something elemental about water and our relationship to it, yet it had never been on the big screen, so it just seemed like a great opportunity to explore the big themes in the story.
And where did it first come to you? What was it that made you think, I've got to do this? Because it feels like such a passionate film.
Yeah, well, it started off actually when I was 13, so it's 32 years ago now. But when I was 13 years old, I had a great teacher, and one day she said, everyone take out a paper and pen and write something about peace. And I ended up writing a poem on Noah I was 13. So Noah is a big character when you're that age. And it ended up winning a contest for the United Nations, and it was the first thing I won as a storyteller and sent me down that path of writing.
You won a United Nations competition when you were 13.
Well, I think it was for school kids.
But
it was,
still,
I wasn't competing against diplomats.
I was still trying to figure out how to do my shoelaces up at that age. I was really interested that you met your fellow producer for much of your career and co-screenwriter on this, Ari Handel.
Oh, you met him?
No, you met him at Harvard originally, hadn't you? And you were a sociology Were you doing sociology?
No, I was social anthropology is what they called it.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And he was
neuroscience, I think. No, I think he might have been in Russian studies, but then he went and he got a PhD in neuroscience after Harvard.
Yeah,
not a dumb guy.
Yeah.
You guys don't. Yeah. So what did you bond over originally, the two of you?
A bong. No, I didn't say that, did I? We bonded over friendship, you know, just we were living next door to each other and we just hung out and I don't know. I don't think in college we weren't the greatest mates. It more happened after college. He was getting his PhD in neuroscience and I was working on film. And he had such a huge brain that I'd often tell him the stories I was working on, and he was very, very clever and able to add a lot to it. And so after he got his PhD, he said he was kind of bored of academia and was looking for another opportunity, and I co-opted him into Hollywood.
Nice. Do you guys ever get together and form the world's most formidable quiz team?
I'm not good with quizzes. He's the one. He's got the brain.
I have.
And we definitely have a weakness in pop culture. I couldn't tell you TV references and stuff. I have friends for that, you know.
Really? Even Breaking Bad? Because you've got Mark Margolis, obviously, voicing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Speaking to a lot of people after this film, the one thing that you do when you walk out of this film is you have something to say. I think it connects with people. It pushes them. What do you say to people who say to this film, well, that wouldn't have happened? And, for example, there are these glowing rocks that form a kind of sparking banner-style fire ignition.
Yeah.
People say, well, what's that to do with anything? Where does that come from?
Well, it does come from. Everything comes from something. There's this one word in the story of Noah in the four chapters, this use of a word called sohar, which is actually what it's called in the movie. And it's a very strange word where it's used in the Bible. It's the Hebrew word is sohar. And there's been a lot of interpretation for thousands of years about why that word sohar is used there. It's the only time it's used in the Bible. And people have sometimes said it was the window that Noah was able to look out of. And other people say it was a magical stone that burned brighter during the day and dimmer at night. And so that kind of magical stone led us to sort of taking and creating some type of energy source for that world, for that pre-diluvian world. That's kind of what we did. We sort of set up a fantastical pre-diluvian world, because when you actually look in the Bible, it talks about everything in it is a miracle. It's a time without rainbows. There's angels walking on the planet. People are living for hundreds of years. Everything in that world is fantastical. It's not this world. So we wanted to create a Lord of the Rings mythical place.
One of my favorite features of the film are the fallen angels. Mm. There's astonishing visuals. For me, I got a kind of a Ray Harryhausen kick out of it.
Mm.
Is that what you were channeling? These are kind of multi-limbed, six-limbed, walking almost golems.
Yeah, well, the golem idea was a big idea for us because, you know, we're dealing with an ancient Jewish text, so it made sense. But, you know, the problem is when everything that ILM was showing me at the beginning were, you know, these giants, and they kind of had movement like humans. And, you know, for the last 10-15 years, you guys are sci-fi fans, you know, we've seen so many of those giants. I really wanted to break away from that aesthetic, and I was like, well, you know, we should go back to some type of stop motion feel. But the thing I more was going for was this Parkinson's feel, because the idea of these creatures is that they're crippled and they're prisoners of the planet, and they're sort of these forms of light that basically are being punished and shackled to the planet. So I was trying to show their discomfort, and that's kind of where that movement came from.
Fascinated from your perspective on what it was like to be on the inside of this movie, because there were stories about the edit and the fact that it was pre-screened for specific American audiences.
Yeah.
And the Noah as a story has resonance with lots of different faiths, not just Christianity, but, you know, Judaism and Islam as well.
Yeah, sure.
So for you as the kind of bellwether for all of these different kind of passions that people have for this text.
Yeah.
And for the studio trying to balance all that stuff. How stressful was it? You know, can you put it on a scale of 1 to 10?
It sucked. It was terrible. Because, you know, we all agreed on the script we were greenlighting, and the film I was producing was that film. And then people started to go, you know, then there started to be all this doubt. But, you know, everything is in the film for a reason, and it's all respectful of the original text in the same way I was respectful to Requiem for a Dream when I adapted it, but even more so because that I had 300 pages of a novel to turn into a 100-minute long film. You know, when you're dealing with four chapters, you have to sort of respect every single word, every line, every possible interpretation. You're trying to honor it. So the film honors Genesis. It just basically interprets it and breathes life into it for, you know, a 21st century audience. And I think at a certain point, the studio, you know, wanted, like they always do, Iron Man. And I was saying, look, you know, I would like to have Iron Man too, but we know that the Russell's character goes really dark in this film, and I don't have Robert Downey Jr., you know, basically being the great entertainer that he is. I have a guy going into the darkest of darkest places, considering doing the most terrible thing possible. How are we ever going to compete? That's not what this film is. But eventually they realized that that was the DNA of the material, that the material that we shot was that. And eventually they got behind me and they fully supported me. It just took it, you know, when you're dealing with that amount of money, it just gets scary.
Were they just thinking of franchise potential?
Yeah. There was never that issue, which is great.
What do you call Noah 2? I mean,
yeah, well, there's really... the next story is Babel. And Babel's actually a pretty good story, you know. But, you know, I don't know if you have read Snow Crash.
Yes, I have. It's astonishing.
Yeah, they have some great stuff from Babel in it. So maybe we do that next.
I think Joe Cornish was attached to that.
Was he? That would be a good interpretation. It's a great, great project. It's just huge.
If you haven't read Snow Crash, guys, you need to go and read it.
Snow Crash is fantastic. Does it hold up, though, I wonder? Because I read it 15 years ago. I wonder. It starts off with guys like rollerblading or something. Isn't there? You'd have to update it.
Super skateboarders.
That would have to change a little bit.
They deliver a lot of pizza.
Yeah, exactly. But there's still great shit in it.
Speaking of vision, there's another bit I love with what I'm calling an armadillog, but it's an armadillo type dog.
Armadillog. That's pretty good.
Which is a creature you meet early on.
Yes.
And this is kind of what I was talking about earlier. There are elements to this story which I think shock people who think they know Noah because they read it in a pop-up book.
Yes.
That's very patronizing, but just...
No, but it's true. That's not patronizing. What you're trying to say, which is the truth, is that it's been turned into a fable and a nursery rhyme and songs for kids. And, you know, Playmobil has a Noah set. You know, it's an ancient toy for kids. But this actual story, and when you read it in the Bible, is the destruction of creation. And for me, when I heard it as a kid, I have memories of being afraid, because we all know, you know, the little lies we tell as little kids, or the little thing we stole or whatever we did that was bad. We all like are living with that fear. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm not good enough to get on the boat. I don't want to drown. I'm not Noah. But it never says in the Bible that Noah was good. It says he was righteous, and righteous does not mean good. Righteous, it's a very curious word that took me 6 months to sort of studying to try and figure out what it meant. And what most theologians say it means is a balance of justice and mercy, which, just to finish, as a parent, you can sort of understand. If you're too just with the child, you can destroy them with strictness. And if you're too merciful, you can spoil them. And the balance of that is what makes a righteous person. But that doesn't mean you're good.
So when Bill and Ted describe someone as a righteous dude,
Bar Marley's righteous is, you know, well, you know, who knows what it is.
Now, you met the Pope, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Not that long ago. Is he a fan of Requiem for a Dream?
I don't know. We didn't get into any details.
He's more of a wrestler guy, I think. Like,
no spoilers on this one.
He loves costumes, so I think the wrestler's all over.
Yeah.
I just realized we didn't actually touch on the armadillo. Where was the origin of the armadillo dog?
Well, from the brain of Adrian Moreau, the best makeup guy in the business. I shouldn't share with Empire readers because all my favorite filmmakers will try to steal him. But, you know, we always wanted to create a animal kingdom that was similar to ours, but wasn't your typical giraffe and elephant and zebra situation. We didn't want it to look like a zoo. We wanted to reinvent the animal kingdom and the whole feel of the film.
No portholes with giraffes' heads sticking out.
No portholes Well, that's not in the Bible. You know, the thing that's so bizarre is that all religious art got the ark wrong. And if you actually look in Genesis, is a perfect description, you know, down to the cubit.
of the measurements and the proportions of the ark.
And it is, you know, a very, very, very big box. I'm just grateful no one got seasick. Cause
yep, but that's what ark means. Ark actually means box. So
hence,
there you go.
You know, raiders, they're off.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
Go.
Have you been to Mount Ararat?
No, I haven't.
It's a great mountain.
One of the best mountains.
Oh, man.
Is it?
It is.
You've been.
What qualifies for a good mountain?
It's big. So big.
It's height. Is that it?
So, honestly, it's one of my main proponents for judging whether a mountain is a mountain or not.
You're quite shallow when it comes to mountains.
Now, we touched earlier about pop culture, and you had friends that would answer your pop culture questions.
Yeah.
This hasn't stopped you being linked to big pop culture icons like...
Right.
Hugh Jackman's Wolverine, who is currently in town. Is this something that might happen in the future? You might be brought back into that superhero world, or was that a possible just a diversion?
I don't know. I mean, I'm always interested. The problem is all the holy grails are sort of taken, aren't they? You know?
Speaking of Raiders.
Yeah, exactly. But so I don't, you know, maybe if something emerged, I'd love to do it. I love superhero films. And so I got really close on a few of them. I just hasn't worked out.
Because you were in talks, or you had early talks or a meeting, Batman,
yes.
Year One, before Christopher Nolan kind of came and got involved. Was it just one meeting? Was it?
Oh, no, no. Me and Frank Miller wrote a couple of scripts. We worked together on some scripts of it, yeah.
Was there a lot of your, I mean, just coincidentally coming from a different angle, but was there a lot of your vision in the Batman Begins?
Not really. No, I think Nolan's version is exactly what the studio wanted. I think I was much more of a gritty feel is what we were going for. But we eventually, I got to make The Fountain. That was the film I really wanted to make. And I just chose to pursue that than to stay on that. I think I was a bit, I probably wasn't in the right place. I had too many stories I still wanted to tell. And I just wanted to make The Fountain for all that time. And that was the one we followed.
And your version of Batman, of course, would have seen the Batman who might have been naked on a beach drinking wine.
Which, I'm sure that scene would have happened.
If you live to be like Noah, 950 years old,
yeah.
They'll rebooted Batman 47 times.
More than that.
So you'll get a chance.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Just make that happen. We did a big celebration of movie soundtracks on Empire Online last year.
Oh,
and
cool.
I spoke to Clint Mansell about working with you way back.
Yes.
He's been your collaborator since day one, pretty much.
Mm.
And he speaks obviously incredibly fondly of meeting you in the first place and
yeah,
the serendipity
sure.
of that. He said that he got a check, I guess a royalty check for Pi just recently when I spoke to him, which was last year, for $169.
Yeah, there we go.
Are you still getting checks through?
Once in a while, it shows up. Keep renting that movie. Keep buying that movie.
Right.
It gets through. The thing about that film, it was done totally socialistic, where everyone... I mean, I own less than I think Clint owns. I own 1.2% of that film. I
wish you owned 3.142%.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. Working on it.
There is a sequence in this film which is kind of the origin.
Mm.
And I felt as I was watching it, this is going to get studied. Did you feel like when you were pitching this film, that when you were creating this film, that was going to be a really special moment? It's the origin of everything.
Well, I always knew when we first wrote it, when Ari and I first came up with the idea of it, we got excited about doing a single shot from the Big Bang all the way through to the Garden of Eden. And for me, it was one of the major reasons I did the film was to do that sequence.
I'm glad you said that because you feel it as you watch it.
We always had the idea of, you know, just starting with the Big Bang and moving through that and seeing the formation of the Milky Way and seeing the formation of the Earth and the Moon and water and Earth and then the creatures of life leading up to Eve, you know?
Yeah.
What's it like when you are creating that, presumably with ILM?
Mm.
I've always been curious about how, as a director, you see what they're trying to do. Obviously, they're realizing what you've explained to them.
Yeah.
Are you often going, no, that salamander's too big?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's endless versions of it. We started off first with the plates, and we started off first in Iceland with, I wanted it all to be based in Iceland, at least the start of it, because it's so primordial there, and then we moved to other places on the planet. But the first thing was collecting photographs and creating a photo montage of the backgrounds that would exist between, as the animal moved up the evolution chain. And then there was animations of the different creatures, and there was a lot of discussion of what those creatures were. We did endless research of, you know, kind of you know, there's lots of holes in that pathway from amoeba to us.
Exactly. You have to take that leap from lizard.
Yeah, and who knows if that really was the direction it was, but at least it gives a hint at what was going on.
That would make an amazing flip book to kind of tie into Noah. I would love to see all of your photos just like... Oh, so there
it is. Yeah, that's a great idea.
And a water park, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, again, you're going to feel like I'm pop culture obsessed, but I was wondering whether you'd seen the Japanese take. The Japanese Wolverine was James Mangold and obviously Hugh Jackman. Have you had a chance to see it? Did it compare to your idea for the?
Oh well, it's a very, you know, it would have been. Who knows? I mean, I never got as far as James did down the path of visualizing it. I thought they did a great job with the script, and I think it came live really well, and Hugh's always awesome. So it was, you know, I can't even, you make a film when you're making it, so you have no idea what, I mean, you can sort of have ideas about certain things, but it comes alive when you're actually in three dimensions with a camera, with an actor, and taking advantage of what's in front of you. So it's all, there's so much circumstance involved.
Before we let you go, which we're going to have to do at some point soon, there were a few projects that you were linked with and then potentially unattached to.
Sure.
I don't know if there's anything you can tell us about what you are going to do next, but Red Sparrow was a spy thriller.
And I wasn't really ever
involved
never
really,
with that.
No?
No, people, you know, everyone's quick to publish stories these days, and so they just publish stories all the time.
Does that sort of genre interest you? The sort of espionage thriller.
Sure.
Kind of.
It would be interesting. I mean, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of genres I haven't done yet, and I'd love to explore all of them if I get a chance.
I would love an Aronofsky Bond. That would mean a lot to me.
Yeah.
Great.
I would like to see that. So next up is Too Early to Say.
Early to say. I'm going to take a break, recharge the batteries, and see where I'm at in a little bit.
My last final question is, again, quite silly. Your name is one of the best I have ever heard. Did anybody or does anybody call you Darinovsky?
Oh, yeah, sure. All right, my friends. Thank you guys very much. Thanks for last night.
Okay, it's on to the main event now, reviews. This week there are quite a few new films to talk about, but we're going to start with the meatiest and probably most debated of the bunch, Aronofsky's Noah. So this is a retelling of the Bible story. Russell Crowe is the good man in an evil world who is inspired to build an ark. Ali, tell me more.
I will tell you more. I'll just fill you in more on the cast. We have Jennifer Connelly, obviously his co-star on a couple of films, but most notably A Beautiful Mind as Noah's wife. There's also Noah's adopted daughter, who is played by Emma Watson. Then there is two sons played by Douglas Booth, who's very handsome, and Logan Lerman, who's also very handsome, but is called Ham. Logan Lerman is a prize ham in this film. Anyway, so that's the cast. Also, there's God, who is uncredited cameo by Terry Jones. That's not true. It is in a epic, fantastical, not Sunday school, not kiddie version take on the Bible. That's 100% for certain. But this may surprise all of you, but this Darren Aronofsky movie is quite divisive.
No.
It is. Like, some people are really engaging with it, to the tune of $44 million in the US box office in its first weekend. And this is despite a lot of very fierce opposition from the Bible Belt, shall we say, who disapprove of the way Aronofsky has taken this very short part of the Bible and turned it into something else, has been inspired by it. And there are elements of this, which I'll get into later, which you will understand why they maybe don't like this. But anyway, this, there is no doubt, is an unmodified creative expression of a cinematic auteur. This is Darren Aronofsky's Noah. And there was a lot of conversation, again, we talked about this in previous podcasts, about how Paramount, the studio, was going, oh, can we try and cut this or change this? And we talk about in the interview, quite frankly, with Mr. Aronofsky. But it is his thing now. And that should be congratulated. I think it is a great thing that we have this big, many million of dollar budget blockbuster movie that is a artist's vision. It has got flaws by the boatload, which again I'll get into later, but it is something, capital letters on SOMETHING. I would say that I liked this film. I engaged with it. I thought it was different. I thought it was impressive. I thought it was shocking. And it had an important thing to say about especially the state of this planet. Its eco message runs through it like a stick of rock. There is so much about the flood coming, and you know what has recently been in the news in terms of we're not looking after our planet properly and we are running out of time. So it really hits home on that front, but it makes a few
kind of almost unforgivable flaws, even from, dare I say it, the kind of hokey typeface it starts with. It's weird how you watch this film, and whether you enjoy it or don't, you will leave going, well, he should have done that, and why did he do that? And, you know, it's one of those films that you cannot walk out of it and go, well, that was just plain brilliant. In particular, there are the fallen angels who are part of this story, who help Noah construct the ark. I think visually they're stunning, and I said so as much to Darren Aronofsky. I said, I think they're beautiful. They're stop motion, Ray Harryhausen type, lumbering, rock-like, Transformers-esque creatures. And I just thought they were visually great, but they will possibly make people recoil, because they'll just go, what is this? I don't understand it. This is strange. This is weird. And you've just got to have an open mind to kind of get in on it. Russell Crowe plays Noah. He's a very tortured, as you know from the original story, he's a very tortured man. Does it really well. There is no one else on this planet who could do it. Like, to have that gravitas and to have that presence to pull off this, I think he's very good indeed. I think this movie also suffers from the fact that I felt like the director was a big fan of certain scenes. You know that feeling when you watch a movie and you go, well, he obviously loved this scene, and he loved this scene, and this scene was great. One in particular is something that a lot of people have been praising, is a time-lapse history of the universe's creation, from, you know, a cell splitting to a salamander crawling out of the, you know, a lizard crawling out of the sea to apes to whatever. And that's part of the reason why I said it was controversial in the US in particular. I think that is stunning. I think this will be studied by people in universities for years to come. That sequence is beautiful. But again, like I say, that felt like the focus.
Mm.
Then a couple more scenes will go by, and then there'll be another one where you could feel the white-hot energy of his creative genius, and then it would move on a bit more. I've got lots to say. I'm sorry for talking so much about this. It's intense. It's difficult viewing. Even, as I say, if you do like it, you will also not like it. It's a bit bonkers at times. It takes a while to get going. I feel impressed by it. But I do not love it. I think it is clever and important and big and brash and bold. But let's let somebody else talk.
I would kind of agree with that. It felt to me like there are many, many things about it that I thought were brilliant. And I do admire the fact that it just got made in the first place. It's pretty incredible. I agree with you completely on Crowe. I think some of the other performances are sometimes a little bit iffy, but he is flawless. But it felt to me like a movie of several different parts, which didn't always fit together terribly harmoniously. And I felt like sometimes, you know, the big sort of story arc, I guess, of the third act didn't feel always to flow particularly well through the first two acts. You know, I felt like it felt like there was a story, you know, number one, Noah is a good man in a world of evil men, and we're setting this whole thing up. Number two, Noah's inspired by God to build an ark. Number three, Noah's not sure whether man deserves to survive at all. There's sort of these three different arcs in the film, and they, there was a sort of a shift between them that didn't always sit terribly well with me. And, you know, it did feel a little bit heavy on, well, it's obviously going to be kind of heavy on the religion, not necessarily Christianity. I mean, this is an Old Testament thing. This is the vengeful God. This is not the, you know, lovey-dovey hippie God. And that sort of is sometimes a little bit, I don't know, hard for modern ears, I think.
There's some dark stuff, definitely.
Very dark stuff.
There's some stuff which doesn't really get addressed. There's some incesty stuff in there, which you probably will walk out the film scratching your head going...
But that's the Bible over, really.
It is, I know, but then it's sort of in the convention of a Hollywood film that ends on a kind of Hollywood note of, hey, it does sort of end in that upbeat note, and you're kind of going, you know, that's...
Mm.
Anyway, it's uneven. I kind of found myself laughing at a few bits, out loud disruptively, but... You know.
There are bits that are laughable. I think that's what I was trying to get a handle on. There is.
It's difficult.
There's one particular bit where, in this attempt to modernise this biblical story, I won't reveal what it is, but it is part of the plot, which could possibly be a spoiler. I did hear those kind of film festival haw-haw-haw laughs. From the screening I was in.
But I mean, there's a sort of shonky CG snake. There's Anthony Hopkins talking about berries a lot. He has an entire subplot where he's talking about berries, which is quite difficult not to laugh at. And I've got to confess, when the big Transformers battle did break out, it's difficult. It was difficult for me to sort of take that seriously.
I kind of love that bit. I kind of love that that fight sequence. This film has about 8 tones. It has epic fantasy film a la Lord of the Rings. It has obviously biblical epic. It also has disaster movie. It also has insular hotbox
family drama. And it has like a Lars von Trier almost. I thought of Dogville in the second half of the film when they get on the ark. It turns into this really minimal, weird, intense dark, dark, dark drama that doesn't have any... It's so different from the blockbustery battle where these sort of robot creatures are sort of getting exploderized. Mm. And you're just going, what is this film? It's so many different things going on at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. It's only better than 2012. I'll say that for it. A story with a similar themes and a similar plot. But yeah, it just felt like lots of stuff in it was really captivating visually. And the performance of Russell Crowe anchors it fantastically well. But it did feel like a strange mix of authorship and studio guidance, to me anyway. Regardless of Aronofsky saying that it's very much his film, I'm sure it is, but he presumably bought into the stuff that reminded me an awful lot of things we'd seen in the Isengard battles of Lord of the Rings quite a long time ago, without really adding much to that. That whole idea of, you know, Ray Winston's villain. It just felt really, really thumpingly conventional in a film that was extremely sort of unorthodox, in a good way, often. The final 20 minutes, and still we should have had big grace notes, just felt like it just ended. It just kind of...
He's a bit hamstrung, no pun intended, again, by the source material. There is a...
Yeah, but I mean, he chose to make it, so I don't...
And also, I feel like we can, you know, he's hamstrung only to a certain extent. He introduces a lot.
You're right. I will say you're right. But in the terms of that last 20 minutes, and please, if you haven't read the Bible, I'm sorry. It's not that long, this bit. You can just read it before you watch the film, if you do end up watching the film, where Noah comes back from completing this mission. Spoiler, he does. And he gets wasted. He drinks a lot of wine and is discovered naked. That's something that's there. And that's a weird thing to it. You can't not include it, but it is. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, and I think that kind of...
I think that plays kind of well in the film.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
that
a survivor's
bit.
Guilt thing, which I think works. Mm. And it actually, that bit really works. What Phil was describing, the Tubal Cain, the Ray Winston character.
In the last 20 minutes.
That has kind of...
No, that and the...
We're talking of the film in a whole now, but that character is mentioned in the Bible, but obviously his entire story in this film has been created by Aronofsky. And it's kind of cheesy. It does feel like they thought we have to have a villain who's doing villainous things and trying to fight the good guy and stuff.
But I agree with you about the Russell Crowe stuff.
Obviously, we should wrap this up, but the fact that we're talking about it this much indicates that it does have that power. You walk out of this film, you have an opinion. You have lots to talk about. There is a lot to think about. It is one of those movies. And for that, it should be congratulated. It really, really should. You cannot walk out this movie and go, meh.
Well, I talked to Hugh Jackman earlier this week, and he was saying basically all that Darren Aronofsky wants of one of his films is that you talk about it, and he has certainly succeeded in that case. We gave this 4 stars, which is very much a recommendation. Next up, we've got a much hyped young adult novel adaptation. Divergent has been talked up as a successor to The Hunger Games, and stars Shailene Woodley as a young girl in a sort of post-apocalyptic society who has to choose to join one of 5 factions that control her world, and she has to hide her true divergent nature. So I think I'm going to take the lead on this one. Let me explain what the heck is going on, if I can. So this is in future Chicago, which is walled off, isolated. We don't know what's happened. We don't know why it's happened, but it's on its own. And it's society is divided into 5 slightly ungrammatical factions. There is Erudite, which is the intelligent faction, Candor, the honest people, Abnegation, the selfless, Amity, the friendly types, and Dauntless, who are the daring people. Shailene Woodley plays Beatrice, or Triss, who's grown up in Abnegation. When she goes for testing at 16, she learns that she is in fact divergent, that she is equally attuned to any one of 3 factions. And she has to hide this because for some reason, it's not quite clear why, this is a threat to her society. So she hides that. She chooses to join Dauntless and heads off to join them, and has to compete in training for them because they have a sort of competitive entry system. If you're not in the top, I don't know, 60% of the class, you get cut and you become factionless, and that basically means you're poor and alone forever. And she's, you know, under the additional pressure that she has to hide the fact that she's divergent. She's also, there's a hunky trainer involved there as well. He's played by Theo James. So it's all a complicated setup. And I think the problem with this film is a problem in the book. It's that this complicated setup is never quite justified in the book, for the simple reason that, and I don't think this is a spoiler, there are 2 more books, and the reasons why society has developed this way are sort of the twist in those books. Therefore, you cannot explain it in the first film. You literally can't give anything more. So what I think Neil Berger, who made this film, has tried to do is tried to give just enough explanation of why this would have happened to hopefully keep you going through the film, but it's such a big ask that I think that's going to be the big stumbling block for most people. If you can buy that, if you can just go with it, go, okay, fine. Five factions, for some reason, you're best if you only have one virtue, cool, whatever, then you can kind of enjoy it. You know, really, really good kind of supporting cast in this one. Loads of big name adult actors. You've got Kate Winslet as the head of Erudite, who's the sort of, you know, leader of the whole thing. You've got Tony Goldwyn as Beatrice's dad. And Ashley Judd as her mother. You know, you've got really good people in there, but you just have to buy this huge thing in the middle, which, Phil, I don't think you did.
You'd be right in thinking that, although I now feel like anything I say that's by way of like analysis or criticism should be sort of prefaced by or ended with a question mark, because like you said, I don't know where this is going. I haven't read the books and I'm not entirely sure, but I also feel like it's one of those films where you don't feel like you need to have done that. It should sell itself straight away. Yeah. And it also has that thing of like, it's got the sequel baiting ending. Now, James is at me for not channeling my inner 13-year-old girl enough with this sort of thing. But I'm like, straight away, it lost me. Because first of all, it does that annoying thing of telling, not showing. You know, basic 101. Sure, there's exposition, but this has double, triple helpings of exposition with cherries on top, which runs throughout. It doesn't have enough subtlety in the way it builds the world or explains why this has happened. But I think more to the point, I mean, I haven't read the books and I know they're super popular, but any notion of like dividing a society on such imbecilic lines has just lost me. I mean, the millions of years of evolution and the incredible complexity of humanity reduced to fight the I mean, it just blows my mind, the premise of this. It just seems so ridiculous that this girl is unusual because she's able to be more than one thing. You know, I mean, that's just, to me, ridiculous. And so I'm not really with her on the journey. And the fact that when she does have the sort of Harry Potter sorting hat situation where she has to choose her faction, she leaves her family. She just walks out on them, you know, and you're supposed to be like, wow, she's a really caring, abnegation type person. She's compassionate and caring. And she literally doesn't tell them she's going to do it. She chooses another faction and just walks out. And that's the last she sees of them until whenever. Now, that's not a spoiler because that comes quite early in the piece. But, you know, you're asked to like a lot of people that I found, I mean, I have to say that Dauntless were probably the most annoying group of film characters I've ever seen in any movie. I mean, they're like Hitler Youth without the sense of humor and the cool shorts. They just run around whooping and climbing things for no reason and just being obnoxious.
It's to show that they're dauntless, dude. You know, how else are you going to show that you're daring and courageous? You know, I think they were. I think that's him trying to show, not tell, which faction is which. And I think, you know, he did that as well with the design of the film, with the houses where everybody lives, you know, the abnegation living in these tiny little grey boxes.
Yeah.
Very, very Spartan inside.
I don't know what the point. I mean, I guess this comes later in the franchise or later in the whatever. But I don't know what he's trying to say. I mean, I came out of thinking Starship Troopers without any satire or any point to make.
But I think this is the problem. You know, he's adapting the book, and I think he does a very good job of adapting the book. I think these problems are in the source material.
And Neil Berger, I mean, you know, Limitless was full of interesting ideas. So hopefully he's not doing the next one, I know. But, you know, maybe, I don't know.
I think, you know, as a setup, I think, you know, they do what they have very well. I do think, as we've both said, I think the setup is flawed in itself and it's limited in itself, and that kind of undermines what they actually achieve on top of it. But decent performances, you know. Woodley's pretty good. She's got it's an underplayed sort of a role. Triss isn't always the easiest person to kind of get into, but I think she does quite well. Theo James is just about the right side of brooding. So yeah, we gave this 3 stars.
I would just say one final thing. I think maybe it's a reflection of how good The Hunger Games is, that in its shadow, you know, this maybe pales.
Yeah, that's probably fair. But anyway, Divergent, 3 stars. It is a recommendation, but probably mostly for those who are fans of the books already. Next up, we're getting there. We are getting there. Next up, we have the second film from Richard Ayoade, following The Storming Submarine, which stars Jesse Eisenberg as a man who, frankly, the universe hates. Everything that could possibly go wrong for him, and quite a few things that really shouldn't, do go wrong, and his life gets even worse when a man who looks precisely like him shows up and does his life but better. Phil, what did we make of this one?
Well, Richard Iowati, I mean, his first film, Submarine, was a real attention grabber. I mean, he clearly has a very, you know, he's very cine literate. He has a real notion of what sort of films he wants to make. I like this film because it feels very, very different from anything else you're going to see. I think it's Marmite-y. Not everyone's going to enjoy this. It's quite a dark sort of satirical world. It's a little Brazil, Terry Gilliam, George Orwellian, you know, Huxley, all of those sort
of...
A
bit Kafka as well.
Kafka's probably the best reference point because it's nothing really makes any sense. You know, if you liked... one of my favourite Coen Brothers films is The Hudsucker Proxy because it sets this world where everything's a little kind of off-kilter. And it's like that, but it's a darker kind of world. And you're plunged into that darkness straight away because you see a sort of a suicide and these two... police suicide DNA whatever experts kind of roll up with the ambulance, and they're very much, you know, it's got a very black humor. They kind of immediately analyze Jesse Eisenberg's character Simon James for like his likelihood of killing himself and decide that he's probably quite a high risk, and then they go on their way without, you know, batting an eyelid about it. He is a man that is, you know, is struggling. He's very timid and diffident, and based on the Dostoevsky story, but quite differently, his doppelganger turns up, Simon James. He's Simon James. James Simon arrives, and everybody loves James Simon. He's confident. He's kind of, but he just, everything falls into place for him all the time, and no one recognizes that they're the same. They're exactly the same. No one actually twigs. So, you know, our hero is left in this kind of weird kind of mental sort of hinterland where he's not really sure what the hell is going on anymore, and he's doubting himself.
It's basically sort of a Social Network Jesse Eisenberg versus like Zombieland Jesse Eisenberg. Yeah. You know, the incredibly competent, incredibly smart one versus the very unsure, very, very kind of timid.
Yes,
one.
Absolutely. Good. That's a good analogy. You know, maybe there's the Lex Luthor side as well. He's you know, not malevolent, but he's a very negative, malign force in his life and leads him in strange directions. It's got a great, great cast that Iowati's put together. It's great to see Wallace Shawn getting, you know, being back on the screen more regularly. James Fox turns up. Noah Taylor has a great little part. Mia Wasikowska. And I really enjoyed it. 4 stars. I don't know if everyone else is going to feel as strongly. You probably need to go in.
I will say I have seen it also. I did not like it as
there
much
you go.
As Phil did.
Yeah.
I loved Submarine. I thought it was really bright and smart. I thought this was a bit Brazil light, to be honest.
Brazil light?
Yeah.
It's whether you're willing to accept the filtration of 4 or 5 different ideas of Orwell and Gilliam and all this kind of stuff. Are you willing to accept that as a new inventive idea, or are you going to see all the references too clearly and find yourself detached from it?
Oh, I don't know. I think I kind of saw all of that, but still felt really into it. I think it's just got that. It's that really, you know, Eastern European / Russian bitter comedy, like not just black, but incredibly bleak and incredibly bitter about it comedy, but it's still very, very funny.
Dark chocolate.
Very dark. Like, this is, we're talking 90% cocoa solids here. This is like some seriously heavy stuff.
I wanted to,
but just, I just loved it.
I wanted to see a feature-length version of the Paddy Considine TV show in the film, which I can't remember the name of now. It's like The Duplicator or something like that. It's got some kind of parallel to the main action.
Yeah, it's kind of like Kickstarter.
Yeah, that's great.
Type terrible. He's got this massive sci-fi Garth Marenghi show. Yeah, I wanted to like it. I really like Richard Iowati. No one likes Garth Marenghi's Dark Place more than I, which he directed, and that's Phil's putting his hand up, so he likes it as much.
I do.
There are probably other people as well, but I wasn't blown away by this. I thought the production design was very, very good. I thought the world was well thought out. I thought the camera, the style of the movie was great for it, quite De Palma-esque. But I thought the story itself was a bit lacking.
Okay, so that one got 4 stars from us, which is obviously a big recommendation. Finally, for the big reviews this week, we have the sequel to Rio, which again stars Jesse Eisenberg and Anne Hathaway as blue parrots who face trouble for like an evil cockatoo or something. Tell us more.
Jesse Eisenberg. Oh, God. This is very similar to the first Rio, which came out a few years ago, which was a bit of a smash hit in its own way. Did very well. Colourful, bright, clever, cute, perfect half-term fare, like jolly stuff, and you get more of the same here. It's second helping of that particular sweet apple pie. I have no real problems with this film, apart from maybe the fact that there are, similar to the first film, there are too many characters here. You've got Will.i.am as a bird, and there's Jamie Foxx as a bird, and everyone's a bloody bird. There's too much going on. It kind of keeps all the plates spinning. It kind of keeps it all together. It's obviously one of those scripts that people have really looked over, but it does have too many characters and maybe three plot lines that could have been two and it would have been fine. There's a fantastic sequence where they're playing football, these different macaws, bluebirds, against another type of parrot, redbirds. It doesn't really matter what the plot is, I'll be perfectly honest with you. It's solid family fare that if you have a young niece or nephew or son or whatever, you could do a hell of a lot worse. The voice cast all seem to be doing a decent job, and if someone says they didn't like it, I'd say they'd be quite harsh. Mm. Quite harsh indeed.
If you have a little niece or nephew, take them to the double. And then, but if that sold out, yeah, definitely Rio 2. What sort of chocolate bar would you say the Rio 2 is?
I would say a Rio 2 is a Dairy Milk, 100%. Like, it is so... Or it might be Pop Rocks. Colourful, sparkly, tongue-bursting, sugary stuff.
Interestingly, the last sort of half an hour sort of turns into Avatar, I thought.
There is an Avatar element. It is based in the Amazon rainforest.
Does Jermaine Clement get a song?
Jermaine Clement, who... There's an interview with him on the website, which you'll enjoy, where... here's an example of one of the lyrics where he does a rap. He goes, "You beat me at ping pong, I'll just play ping ponger." Previous film, he talks about how if you try to make a mess of me, I'm going to put you on a rotisserie. So it's that level of forced punnage.
I prefer the first pun, I'll be honest. The second one's a little weak. Now, hang on, correct me if I'm wrong, but the first film was all about these two parrots being the last, these macaws being the last of their species. Now it turns out they totally have family.
They have a huge
family.
They're
not, there's loads of them, it's a lie.
Huge. Oh. It's been a lie all along. There's the twist.
Oh, I feel
lied to. There's too many of them in a way. They need
killing. I can't cope with this anymore. I'm moving on. Also out this week, Mark Cousins' A Story of Children and Film got 4 stars. That is, as the name suggests, about children and film. Honor, which stars Paddy Considine in his second appearance of the week, gets 2 stars. Visitors, which is a surreal documentary about technology, gets 3. And The Motel Life with Emil Hirsch and Stephen Dorff gets 4. And that is it for this week's Empire podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Gareth Evans to talk about The Raid 2 and Sam Claflin to rather confusingly get very loud about The Quiet Ones. Until then, it's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
From Ali.
Bye-bye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to collect some of that Saharan sand, put it in sandbags, just in case Aronofsky was right.